I am here once again with the charming and delightful Paula Bulmer, who is most recently the author of 9 Months. Paula, how are you doing?
Great, thanks, Ed.
By a curious coincidence, I read your book concurrently with Katie Royfe's latest essay collection, In Praise of Messy Lives. And what was interesting, and I'm sure it wasn't the fact that I read them close together, but that the tone of both were actually quite similar. Sonia's voice and Katie Royfe's voice were actually very, very close. And I wanted to ask you about this. I mean, they both wish to wear their messy lives on their sleeves as like a badge of honor. They both don't always understand the impact of their behavior on other people, on their families, and so forth. But what is interesting is the chief difference is that Sonia actually does have some sort of emotional intuition. She is capable of discerning empathy and so forth from others, even if she doesn't necessarily choose to respond to it. And so my question to you, well, there's two. One, I'm wondering if you had any op-ed writers along the lines of Katie Royfe or other double X people in mind when you were working on this book. And two, do you feel that candor or straightforward emotion allows us to deal with these more unpleasant feelings about what it is to be a woman, what it is to be a mother, and so forth?
To answer your first question, I didn't have anybody else in mind. Sonia just became a character in her own right. And I've actually never read an article by Katie Royfe.
Wow.
I don't read a lot of journalism. And I particularly, I read a few things by, say, Caitlin Flanagan, you know, 5 years ago. And yeah. Then now I steer clear from most hyperbolic journalism.
It's just ire-inducing. Too much for that.
Yeah. Life's too short. So that's interesting that the voices are similar. Obviously, not purposefully.
I don't know if I should have told you. With
no,
this answer
I'm just a little shocked because
you did look, but give me this look of like, oh my God, really?
it's all good. And then I'm sorry, your second question was in regard to, I forgot.
Emotional candor, straightforward language, how it allows us to grapple with these particular emotions dealing with motherhood and womanhood. And also, well, while we're on the subject, you know, whether fiction is better at doing this than, say, journalism or op-ed-y kind of stuff.
I don't think fiction is better for it, but it's better for me. I think that fiction is a place where I'm much more comfortable writing. I can, a lot of people ask how autobiographical this is, this novel is. And no, I never left my family for months. I never had an accidental third pregnancy. And one of the main differences between the character and me is that I never stopped writing when my children were little. And Sonia stops being able to paint and feels that her children disrupt her ability to be creative. And I actually had an epiphany when my son was given to me. My first son was born, and he was handed to me. And one of the first thoughts, you know, first of all, oh my God, he's my beautiful baby. And the second thought was like, I'm never going to blame him for anything in my life. I'm never going to use my kids as a scapegoat. I think my mother did a little bit. Only a little bit. She accomplished so much in her life. But I never wanted my children to be the reason why I didn't do what I wanted to do outside of family. Yeah. My family was always a huge priority. I got pregnant at 27, which is unheard of in New York. But I never wanted to not write. So other people go into the gym or you had lunch with friends and I would hit the computer.
Yeah.
It took me a long time to get published, but I was always writing. And Sonia, her children really get in the way. And for me, there was they're taking a nap. Here, I'm going to write 2 paragraphs. Woo. So it wasn't that it wasn't a struggle at times, but never not to her extent where she just can't manage both identities, sort of.
You know, J. Robert Lennon wrote Pieces of the Left Hand the same way. The kids were there for a nap, then he would write like a few paragraphs. So, you know, this is a very common thing for writers who are also taking care of kids and so forth. The path not taken. That's what I'm getting here with Sonia.
Yeah, that's one way, exactly. That's a good way to look at it.
You know, so I'm wondering, this is probably getting into personal territory, but did you harbor any kind of anxieties over the idea of having sort of a third kid? Or
definitely. Yeah. This book was written when I was thinking of having a third kid.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a book talking myself out of it.
Really? You had to write a piece of fiction to talk yourself out of family planning?
Actually, no. I'm just trying to be funny here. Yeah. But it's all, there's some truth to it.
Yeah.
I was.
I figured there was.
I hadn't sold my story collection yet, but my stories had gotten some attention by agents, and everybody wants to know, do you have a novel? Do you have a novel? And so I'd say, okay, I'm working, you know, on this novel, and then I really started working very hard on it, and then it still took 10 years later before it got published. But It's a hard thing to let go of having babies. Babies are a little addictive. That's why you see families with like 10 children and who aren't Catholic. And there's something about, I think I hit on it also a lot in one story in The Second Son. In my collection, I have this woman who just keeps saying, you know, oh, the new baby's full of possibility, whereas the older children start to disappoint slightly.
Yeah.
And having, you know, having children is, besides, you know, infancy being incredibly exhausting and tiring, it's the most intense love affair. And you love your children. I love my 13-year-old and I love my 16-year-old, but my 16-year-old's off all day long, like with girlfriends. And, you know, it's just not the same thing as holding this infant who's still almost part of your body. And that intensity is a hard thing to say, I'm never going to do that again.
Yeah.
And everybody does it at a different time. I have respect for people who have no children, one child, you know, five children, whatever your thing is.
Yeah.
No one should judge. And there's a lot of, you know, this book deals with a lot of all the judging.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, you're not having, I had a lot of, you're not having a third. And there was this group of women and they were all having their third. And I just was saying, no, I have my boys either my left and my right arm. I'm not missing anybody. Nobody's missing here.
But the emotional intensity you allude to that comes as the kids grow up.
Yeah.
This is also another issue which I didn't intend to talk to you about, but since you brought it up, there was a blog post I read off of Metafilter, as a matter of fact, the other day, where this woman wrote this, you know, the absolute emotional devastation she felt at that moment where she finally had to say goodbye to her kid when the kid went off to college.
College, yeah.
Yes.
Empty nest syndrome.
And just the empty nest syndrome.
Oh my goodness, not a joke.
And just the complete emotional breakdown she had.
Yeah.
And what was interesting about the thread, and I sort of sympathized with a number of different points, but a lot of people said, wow, this is really hyperbolic. A woman would not have this kind of extreme emotion. But then a part of me was saying, well, actually she would. Or maybe there's just something in the translation of words that forces something to become more intense than the actual feelings that you're feeling, or perhaps less intense.
Well, also, everybody's different.
Yes, yes.
That's the main thing. Everybody feels differently about certain junctures in their life.
Yes.
For instance, I was really happy to graduate from high school, and other people pine for those high school days when they were like the big quarterback or whatever. You know?
Yeah.
So I think I'm going to have a really hard time empty nest. I'm having a hard time just dealing with the fact that they don't come home for dinner every night. I remember talking with two older women up in Binghamton where I used to spend my summers. And one, at the age of 45, she had three boys who were all almost out of the house, had a baby because she just couldn't deal. So she just had a baby like 10 years later after her other three kids.
Yeah.
And another woman was like, when I was dropping my son off at college and we were walking up the stairs and down the stairs and up the stairs with the chair and the desk. And then finally I was like, good riddance. And she said, there was no problem. It was time.
Yeah.
So everybody's just, you know, everybody's different.
Yeah. Well, the question I had, which I was going to get to, although this is all fantastic, I love the babbling and so forth and rambling. You know, the notion of facing an empty nest reality versus looking back to your own life as Paula for Sonia,
mm-hmm.
to how you felt when the kids were just becoming presences and who kept you up at all hours and so forth. I'm curious, you know, if you see any parallels between looking ahead that might actually help you and looking behind, how much space do you need to go back to certain tangible feelings, or does the idea of the path not taken allow for all sorts of emotional possibilities that, you know, you never would have anticipated being there as you're sitting there getting those precious paragraphs between spare moments?
I would say both. In particular, in regard to this book, a lot of it was written when my children were still quite small.
Yeah.
10 years ago. So 10 years ago, I had a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
And that was the first draft and the whole path not taken and just kind of having a lot of fun, although it was also, you know, hard work, don't get me wrong, but fun imagining someone doing this, running off, doing wild things. And then the other thing is perspective, because I revised and I revised. And then 10 years later, certain revisions, the fact that I'm looking back at that time and, you know, with some nostalgia, definitely affects certain aspects of the novel.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how so? Maybe you could elaborate on this. How does that nostalgia, is that altogether a beneficial thing? Could it be a harmful sort of feeling?
Perspective and nostalgia can be interchangeable. And mostly I write from perspective. Rarely, the parts of 9 months where I'm writing in the kind of the rawness of the experience, that's rare. Although it's not a bad thing to do. Generally, I need a few years or even longer. My next book that I'm working on, all the characters are between the ages of 12 and 22. And it's really interesting to write about junior high when you're 40.
Yeah.
It's probably not so interesting when you are 12. Yeah. You know, a 12-year-old, you know. And that's where nostalgia and perspective can, I think, are actually vital. And why I'm... one of my problems, a lot of people are asking about, like, what do you think about all these young people in the small press world and all these 22-year-olds? And I kind of think, you know, if they had waited 10 more years, what would their work would have been like? And would it have been better? And instead of that new style of just saying whatever pops into their head and making
sure
a book.
Well,
I guess it's a little harsh, sorry.
No. It totally makes sense. I mean, but there's kind of a trade-off with time, though. You know, the further you are from something, you have perhaps more bravery to approach the truth. On the other hand, you realize that perhaps there are lingering wounds there or lingering pain that you never would have anticipated, you thought you had actually put away. Did you face this problem at all?
Definitely.
What did you do to confront something like that?
Well, you suffer as a person, and then you try to capture it some way and work it into the narrative if that's a possibility.
Yeah.
But, remorse. I think you're talking about remorse.
Yeah. Or even bad things that you did that you wish you couldn't have done.
You regret.
Sort of, yeah.
That's regret.
Genuine contrition.
Remorse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. I'm someone who every day I do something that I regret.
Yeah.
Well, some people don't. maybe some people more than others. Maybe.
Well,
anyway.
What's an example? What do you regret doing today?
I don't want to get into specific. I don't think.
I don't know.
It just has to do with my
dog. We were
dog.
On the subject.
But I have to do with my son and my dog and my crazy morning. So you don't want to.
No worries.
But anyway.
Well, let's look at this from another perspective. So I was flitting through the Goodreads reviews, and I noticed that someone wrote this. This amused me.
Oh, there's
me.
Some mean ones.
Well, no.
I stopped looking.
Well, this one actually amused me.
Okay.
Paula Bulmer writes about pregnancy as if she were a man.
That's actually a quote on my book.
I said to myself, well, I didn't realize that writing about pregnancy was a gender-based problem. But,
that's interesting.
You know, this is also interesting because I also noticed this rather stupid Guardian article that had been written by Alison Mercer. She claimed that fiction isn't delivering enough birth scenes, and this didn't really reckon with my own reading experience. I mean, you can cite everything from David Mitchell to Anita Diamant to George R. R. Martin. I mean, there's pregnancy and birth scenes in droves. You know, I'm wondering if the idea that writing about pregnancy as if she were a man kind of gets into this almost blindsided way of looking at pregnancy and birth scenes in fiction. They're there, but nobody actually wants to remember it, or nobody wants to really grapple with it as a reality in contemporary fiction. Do you have some thoughts on why you think this is? Does it come back down to this question of candor or being straightforward about feelings?
I didn't see the article that you talk about, and nor all of the books that you mentioned that have birth scenes in them. I don't know any of them. I would be more in agreement, maybe, and that has to do with my narrow focus of reading, that there are not enough birth scenes.
Yeah.
And actually, my first chapter is a birth scene in 9 months, and I have a few birth scenes in my collection of stories. So obviously, I think it's an important thing to write about. And I was told by one person that I should cut the whole first chapter because it's disgusting. And the whole first chapter is
interesting.
Scene.
Yeah.
It, two birth scenes in literature moved me a lot. I don't know if this is completely off topic, but I mean, Sylvia Plath writes about birth in her journal, and it was amazing and to me very freeing. What someone can do this, and she's not a bad person, or she's not disgusting, or whatever. And another is Elizabeth Jane Howard, just the most horrific birth scene, and the way birth and early motherhood was handled in England during the late 30s. Brilliant, very lengthy. The Sylvia Plath one was short. Both of those were huge inspirations, although I read the Elizabeth Jane Howard one after I'd written this book.
Yeah.
But still, that was more of confirmation. These stories need to be told, partially because they're so, all of them are so different. And in regard to Elizabeth Jane Howard and Sylvia Plath, they're different. In the 60s, it was different than the 30s. And, you know, culturally, The Joys of Motherhood, which I've been putting on some lists lately by the great writer Buchi Amacheta, you know, giving birth in rural Africa, you know, I guess I can't get enough of them.
Yeah.
Giving birth is probably the most amazing thing you're ever going to do. It
yeah.
beats, you know, getting your college diploma.
Or so I've heard.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, after, you know, being born yourself
yeah.
and dying, that's going to be the big moment when you give birth.
But the idea that the birth scene you write is disgusting.
Yeah.
This
a female
me.
Writer
I mean,
who writes about motherhood.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
By the way,
or being
me, told me to
yeah,
get rid of
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Or being pegged as writing about pregnancy as a man.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating
okay.
to me that something that is so predicated upon the visual and the emotional can, through language, become something that is verboten, something that is frightening, something that terrorizes or people want to excise from their lives. And I think this is really what I'm trying to grapple with. Why do you think we don't want to confront this truth of all truths?
It's
I mean,
terrifying.
Death actually gets a better representation
I
on
agree.
The page.
I
yeah.
agree with
we
you.
We have no
death,
problem like maiming,
war,
raping.
Death. Yes,
yeah, yeah.
rape. It's all good.
Yeah.
But birth, no.
Yeah, I know.
No, I think so in that way... I'm actually now, I'm going to have to get that list of books that you mentioned, all these other people writing about birth.
1,000 Autumns of Jacob Desood opens with a birth scene.
Okay, great.
Yes,
I'm getting a list.
Which is great,
the,
by the way. Yeah,
yeah. Okay. But I think, you know, it's funny, death, war, rape.
But
birth in some way, the thing about death is then it's mystery.
Yeah.
And it deserves to be written about a lot. But birth is then the beginning of life, so it, which is its own mystery, but it's very animal.
Yeah.
And it's not us at our human best. It's not, you know, godliness. It's really, really animal. And that's why it's interesting to read, you know, how they handle it in the 30s, they try to take all the animal out of it to make
yeah.
it less, you know, put you out with ether, rip the baby out
yeah.
of you, pretend nothing really happened. Oh, here's your baby.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't go through this kind
of... It came from the stork, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It came from the stork. So I think birth scares us. There's a sociological theory or a linguistic theory that the things that we're most scared of, we have more names for. I think
yeah.
you've probably heard that. And, you know, that's why our genitalia have different, you know, 50 million different ways to say the word vagina. And birth comes from that thing of vagina, of like you have to have 50 million ways of like trying to avoid what it is because it scares us.
Well, hopefully that Naomi Wolf book will straighten this whole problem out.
What?
She's got a book called Vagina that's coming out.
Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah, which I'm really looking forward to reading. Yeah,
yeah. Another person, I don't read a lot of nonfiction, so
yeah.
I've read very little of her. I know people think highly of her and that she's...
I like her. I've talked with her. Yeah,
yeah, and she's considered a great feminist thinker.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you think that we're afraid of birth or those early years because we have no memory of it?
That's maybe part of it. I remember my children's early years,
yeah.
but because we
but
don't
our
remember
births,
our
we don't
own.
Remember. Yeah.
No, we just hear stories sometimes.
Yeah,
and it becomes that's funny because a lot with my children, you know, we always talk, not always, but often we talk about stories of when you were three and when you were two and how you came into the world and you were a surprise, you know, or
yeah.
you were planned, and there's all these kind of and these are kind of the we build up stories of ourselves that we have no recollection of.
Yeah,
that's and yeah, maybe that's definitely part of the weirdness of it all.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, to know about our origins through hearsay.
Exactly.
He wouldn't stand up in a court of law. No. I want to talk about the geographical nature of this book. You're careful to demonstrate how the notion of bad motherhood changes from location to location. Of course, we start off in Brooklyn, and what is considered gauche here is, in fact, going to be more permissible in a place like Brighton or South Bend, Indiana, where the book concludes. Do you feel that this yardstick for appropriate motherhood originates in some way through Brooklyn? I mean, you know, reading your book, I was thinking to myself, God, you know, this whole idea of New York as the center of the universe is such bullshit. Yeah. And to think that actually a good chunk of the sort of parenting industry is predicated upon that viewpoint, which is further promulgated by bullshit in magazines, yes, and stupid New York Times articles and stuff, which are all in New York. Yeah, exactly. That this sets the standard for how you should parent. When you think about it geographically, that is truly a monstrous idea. Yeah. As someone who likes to get out of the city from time to time, too, I find the notion of being trapped and having a notion of something pivotal in life rooted in city also utterly
wrong
and yes, quite damaging, I would say. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I've talked about it before, so I'm going to try to put a little fresh spin on it, but I'm from South Bend, Indiana. And even though I left at 14 and I've lived in New York for 22 years and raised my children here, my childhood in Indiana greatly affects the way I see New York parenting, which is to say ridiculous in many ways.
Yes.
And I feel like there's a lot of books coming out. My publisher, Bronwyn Huruska, is coming out with a book called, I'm spacing here, The Adderall Problem in Children. There's these private schools where half the children are on Adderall, and she actually had a piece in the Times, a nonfiction piece, talking about how she took her kid off of it when she just realized that they're juicing you to stay in school.
Yeah.
And I talk about medicating preschoolers in 9 months, and that is based on, the first half of this book, the characters, not entirely me, but a lot of the observations, I knew people who had their four-year-olds on Prozac because they were so anxious.
Yeah.
What four-year-old should be so anxious that they need to be medicated?
Yeah.
And this, you're not going to find that in South Bend.
Yeah.
You know, I played kick the can,
yeah,
and I like roll around on the grass and I was bored. And I made sure that my children were bored occasionally. And people thought, you're underscheduled and why aren't you doing, if they're not bored, are they ever going to develop an imagination? They have to figure out how to entertain themselves a little bit. I don't, want them busy from 8 till 6, Monday through Sunday,
But there's also the issue in your book where you say, well, I grew up watching television for many hours, Sonia says this, and I don't see how it's necessarily going to be a bad thing for my kid, which is sort of an...
I think that was Clara.
Clara, apologies.
No,
yes,
that's okay.
There's that thing. And then, of course, there's the moment where they're talking about, like, finding any abnormality within a school with which to sort of, keep them doped up or to,
Well, that's Brownwood said, once you start looking for... a problem, you're going to find one.
Exactly.
And I saw that happen here on a preschool level to the point where it terrified me. And I made my husband go to the Midwest for a week-long vacation. And I said, let's move here. I can't believe it because I so wanted to get out of Indiana.
Yeah.
When I was 14, I was running. I would have run, all my... But raising children here is a challenge to keep it kind of normal.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe things have changed a lot in Indiana, but I can't imagine that they're anything like the uber competitive world that we have here in New York, which is probably the same in LA. Any San Francisco, any kind of big competitive city is going to be different than raising your child, on a farm in Wyoming or whatever.
Do you think there's something about the metropolitan environment that encourages parenthood to be more competitive than in rural or suburban areas?
I do, and I think it's a shame, and I've said this, but I don't mind repeating it. I feel like it's a corruption of something that parenthood is such a wonderful and also difficult time. It's a time where we should be helping each other, we should be kind towards each other, and yet everywhere I turned, it became this like, well, my kid goes to this school, and I was supposed to be impressed, or my kid, does these, many activities a week, and it's not that I don't want to be proud of my children. I am proud of them, but I don't want it to be a competition in the public sphere.
Yeah.
My pride, I mean, I'm very proud of them when they do, you know, their concerts, or that's public pride, but mostly there's your private life as a family, and then there's who you are publicly, and it's an interesting way, it's interesting to see how people handle that.
Yeah, sure. You're also, you established Sonia as a painter.
Right.
Which we talked about, and I'm kind of curious about this, because Clara, who we also mentioned, a side character, she has this master's degree in health administration.
Okay.
You know, it is interesting that in an age in which Marissa Meyer can get into the headlines for being the pregnant CEO of Yahoo, that your book would not actually combine the idea of occupation and motherhood. And I was curious as to why you refrained from that in this novel.
Well, I guess when, you know, I was basically a stay-at-home mom, so that was kind of more my experience.
Yeah.
Although some of my closest friends, in fact, my closest friend worked full-time from the age of her kids were 3 weeks, and I never judged her. That was one thing, was the whole camps. I never understood the camp. But I did want to make her a character who was struggling to balance her life as an artist, and actually failing, as opposed to kind of, you know, I think, yeah, I did all right. I don't know. I've never been much of a corporate worker. I was a bartender.
Yeah.
And I worked in publishing briefly. So to create this kind of character who balances things and has this great job and children, and I'm sure there are many women out there, and I applaud them. My best friend, you know, she works at Merrill Lynch. She works, and both of her children are amazing, and she never breastfed them for 1 second, literally not for a day. And she's a great, great mother. And the opposite of me, I was kind of at home and nursing and, you know, writing when I could, and it's all good. But I guess lack of experience would be why I wouldn't, you know, that would be writing so far off what I know.
Yeah. Well, aside from your friend, aside from your friend, did you ask anybody you knew who worked and who was also raising kids? I mean, did you think to investigate this?
I have many acquaintances, yeah, but my best, it's just ironic that my best friend is, yeah, the, you know, C-section, no breastfeeding.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, who cares what's going on at the playground? Make the nanny deal. Like, she, but also, fantastic mother, great kids. You know, we vacation together. It's been 10 years now, and just my favorite person in the world.
Yeah.
So, and I know, yeah, other acquaintances who, you know, a couple of lawyer friends, and actually some of the biggest mistakes I've seen are women who gave up their intense corporate life to then become the president of the PTA and just terrorize everybody. And it's like, you know what, lady, you really should be back in the office.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as an insult. I just think everyone has to know where, what they, I'm kind of a reclusive artist type. So what I made my choice to do what I do, and it worked out. It's working out well. I did the right thing.
So you feel that drawing from personal experiences, you're going to get a greater sense of verisimilitude and satire and life on the page that way than writing about almost an entirely foreign notion of motherhood.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be able to capture the life of a CEO at Yahoo unless I at least spent a couple of weeks there. You know, yeah, yeah. I have never worked at a large corporation. I worked at small presses.
Yes.
And I worked at small restaurants. I've wanted to write about, well, my next book, like I said, is very different. There was not one mother in,
yes,
it. So, I'm proud of it, but the last two books are deal with not totally autobiographical, but the world I know.
Yes.
A little bit.
What do you think of Bloomberg's present war on formula? Have you heard about this?
No.
Yeah, he wants to basically like get formula locking it away in the hospitals so people can't access it and things like this.
I'm also mad. I'm still mad people can't smoke in bars. and that's terrible for me to say as like a person. Yeah. Anyway.
I suspect you're one of those people who actually wants large soft drinks, too.
Yes. I'm like, you know, that's what you want to do.
I will confess that when that ban came into place, I started drinking more orange soda. You know, they actually did probably more for the, I wanted to rebel, you know?
That's funny that you say that, because I was thinking about certain things that I would do in this book and that Sonia does that are parallel. You're really not supposed to write about these things. You're, yeah, really not supposed to write about a woman smoking pot or, like, yes, having sex on the side of the road. And So the minute someone says you're not supposed to write about those things,
you want to
I'm
going to
try
it.
To write about yeah. it and make it feel right in the book.
Yeah.
You know, not right like morally, but right in the book. And then I didn't know what... I honestly, breast milk is best. But some people aren't going to breastfeed. So we have formula. And those babies do fine. And all those tests about whether they're smarter or not, that just makes smoke blow out of my ears. And then that whole baby Einstein thing, you
yeah.
know, like listen to, you know, the Talladega yeah. Nights where like, baby Jesus, listen to your little baby Einstein. Like, that was, like mocking that whole thing. It needs to be mocked.
Yeah.
We really need to mock the idea that we're so concerned about the intelligence of our children that we're doing studies of them in the womb. Study other things in the womb. You know, study like how to, I don't know, but how intelligent they're becoming via, you know, the minute the egg meets the sperm. It's just like,
because
you really want
too.
Your kid to go to Yale,
yeah.
you know? I just, that I just don't get.
Well, so, you know, the sense I get from talking with you before, from talking with you now, is that it's probably easier for you to rebel than it is to, I guess, tell it straight. Why do you think that is, and why do you think so many people don't want to write about smoking pot while pregnant or having sex with a Colin Farrell-like trucker on the side of the road?
Wait, I'm... You think that satire is a useful tool to get at things that people don't want to hear about. Or comedy in general is so underrated. Satire being, actually, I was discussing the difference between satire and farce, and I really think that I hopefully did a good job of staying in the satirical mode and not quite getting into farce. But
you were about to quibble with my thesis, which is that you find it easy to rebel, or were you?
Okay. I do... I'm perfectly fine with being seen as a rebellious writer. All sorts of the words that in these past two books, edgy, unflinching, things like that, I'm really happy with. And nonfiction is just something other, but you, like you're saying, Katie Royfe, that's for other people to do. But I'm more.
But we're not talking about perception.
Okay.
I'm talking about you.
Okay.
Do you feel that you're rebelling on the page?
I do.
You do.
And it feels good.
It feels good.
Yeah.
It's easier then. Easier than writing about a very staid, typical sort of suburban kind of...
No, all right. So, well, you mean character. Well, I was going to say some of the stories in Baby are not funny.
Yeah.
And are actually, were really... And were harder to write, but I don't not write in that mode. This book, with a novel, you have to stick, I think, stylistically. Even though there's a lot of serious things going on, there's sadness... But it's funny and it's satirical. But I don't know if you remember the story, The Second Son.
Yes.
That's pretty much pure autobiography. And I wept writing it.
Yeah.
And it's not something people want to hear, like the difficulty of, you know, you kind of have this breakup with your first child when the second one comes. And I think I wrote about it with absolutely no humor.
Yeah.
So I can do that. The story Homesick is not funny. Trying to think of other things that aren't funny. So... And then I'm not rebelling, even though I am trying to write about things that are uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I like to try to face the uncomfortable, and humor's one great way of doing it, but not the only way.
Then I must ask you, what do you think is the most comfortable story or scene that you have ever written?
You mean while I'm writing and I'm
feeling
all comfortable?
Where you felt like this is a very comfortable situation... you know, and then you perhaps feel the later need to rebel. I'm curious about this.
You mean what I'm writing is too comfortable as opposed to not facing something?
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like there's some sort of unnaturalness that comes if you're writing about something too comfortable at all?
I just think it would be kind of boring.
Yeah.
I want to read people being brave about things I want to feel that the author is being brave when writing about whatever.
Yes.
And that's not the only thing. Sometimes just pure lush description and taking you into different worlds. But usually there has to be an undercurrent of like, okay, something's going to go wrong here, because that's life. Things go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then we try to bounce away from it. And then you can put the beauty in there as well. Usually there's that.
Yes.
Bothness. That was the term coined by David Foster Wallace that is has become kind of a mantra for me, bothness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, what about shifting from short stories to writing novels?
That was really hard.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering if you did some sort of compartmentalization. I think of the whole incident with the hamburger meat, which almost could be its own discrete story. And yet actually is also part of this larger narrative. What did you do to...
When she goes grocery shopping?
Yes, exactly. And except they have a gourmet and the woman and all that whole... that whole scene. That could have been a short story in Baby. But it works also in the context of the novel.
Okay.
So, you know, my question is did you adopt any kind of strategy to compartmentalize the structure where, okay, this is kind of a story, but it's within the larger framework? How did you design the larger framework? And also I have to ask you about this because... she actually doesn't leave until the last 100 pages.
Right.
Which I found interesting. I was waiting for her to leave because you know she's going to leave. And I liked that tension.
Oh,
so,
you did.
You know, so what of the waiting to the last possible moment? Did you break the stories down to, did you break the
chapters
down into individual stories? What happened here?
Well, it went through many phases. And, I hope it's not the most rough transition from story writing to novel writing, but, you know, I did my best. Other people weren't as happy as you were waiting for it, but a lot of that's the flap copy.
Yeah.
You know, the flap copy says she's going to go on this journey. So that's what you're expecting.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not disagreeing with the people who wrote my flap copy. I'm just saying that there was no promise that the whole thing was going to be a road trip. That chapter, well, I tried, I had an outline and then I had to deviate from the outline.
Yeah.
Particularly, the outline didn't have me, the birth chapter came to me, and I decided I was going to keep that at the beginning, even though I knew that I wanted to have this book take place over 9 months.
Yeah.
So I did know that, I did want it quite linear. But it's not completely linear. You know, the first and last chapters are out of it, are out of the linear narrative.
Yes.
But the rest is linear. And Philip Roth in Zuckerman Bound, which was a huge touchstone for me throughout writing this book, I went back to it over and over again during revisions. And then even if you look at American Pastoral, how it ends, or big chunks of Sabbath Theater, he also just kind of has these long periods of like intense dialogue and then really stretched out scene and then a condensation of time and then a really stretched out scene and then a condensation of time. And I liked that. I like that. And someone, I think an Amazon reviewer said, this is one of those books that kind of reads like big chunks of rants. And she has a point. But gratefully, she said, and usually that bothers me, but it worked for me in this book. And I was like, you know, I want people to like the book.
It's interesting because the last time we talked about this, the dreadful people who have basically said, you cannot write this as bad writing and all this.
Yeah.
You know, why are you still hung up on some of this? You know, you're clearly writing from this place of... joyful confrontation to a certain degree. You want
good.
To
like
actually... tackle and grapple the issues. So, you know, with this in mind, if you know, you know, you have a history of people wildly misinterpreting your work, calling you a bad mother,
yep,
the devil,
face.
And so forth. You know, why then should the viewpoints of other people matter for you?
I don't lose sleep over it usually.
Yeah.
I lost some sleep when a mentor, a very famous writer, wrote me a nasty letter. Reading a Goodreads thing, which I actually have stopped reading them.
Good.
Every now and then I'll go and maybe take a look, but same thing. You know, Amazon, my book just came out yesterday.
Yeah.
So I had to glance at it. And actually, I'm even though I'm not early in age, I'm early in my career. This is only my second book.
Yeah.
So I think younger... even though I'm not younger in age or newer authors, when you're first starting out your career, I think of myself as still starting out a career, I hope. I'm still going to be a little sensitive, and I'm okay with that. My skin will get thicker as things go on, and I hope they do go on. And
But wait a minute. That's nonsense. I mean,
what's,
you know,
nonsense?
You aren't obligated to develop a thick skin as a writer. You're obligated to be the best writer that you can be.
That's true. Well, regarding the work,
yes,
that's all I've always trying to go for.
Yeah.
regarding my reaction to how people read my work, there's nothing wrong with, you know, oh, I don't read my reviews anymore. Or, oh, I don't care what people think. I'm just doing the best that I can and writing what I think's important. And when I'm doing my work and when I'm finished with it and putting it out there, that's one thing. And it comes from a place of, you know, this is what I've dedicated my life to. This is what I care about. I'm trying very hard to do something that hopefully is important, entertaining. And I don't mind, you know, entertaining is important. I don't want someone to be bored.
Yeah.
But I don't want it to be, you know, it has to mean something. There is this whole, like, meaningless thing that goes kind of around in the literary world right now, which I'm just not into. I want to grapple with the big issues: love, life, birth, death, marriage. And someday, well, actually, I have a book that takes place when the wall fell down in Berlin. So in that way, it's a very political novel.
Yeah.
So yeah, and then people's reactions to the whole, that's a different thing. There's writing and wanting it to be read, and then your reaction to what people think about it. And even like huge authors like Jonathan Franzen, he called the New York Times reviewer an international embarrassment because he thinks she's a joke, you know? And
Takatani,
because she didn't like the corrections, right? And Jonathan Latham wrote a whole essay recently about being angry about someone's reaction.
About James Wood,
And
the irony is that James Wood was actually being very complimentary about the book, too.
I didn't think it was a bad review. I went back and read the review, and I was I got that review.
And it's like, you know, hey, man, it's after a certain number of years, why do you want to actually this grudge? You know?
I know. Yeah. But the irony is that we're a bunch of pussies, and that we just really are. We pretend like we don't care, and you got normal. Yeah. But normal mailers punching someone in the face because his feelings were hurt, you know? Like, because he's a little pussy.
Yeah.
Seriously.
But you know that he and Gore Vidal, there was one, Gore Vidal had recently died, and I was like reading a number of stories, and someone went to interview Mailer, and Gore Vidal and Mailer were sitting there, and Mailer says, "He's been here a week. He won't go." And, you know, so there is something to be said for the fact that that sort of more pugilistic culture did at least result in these sort of lifelong sort of friendships and so forth that you don't always see these days because people want all or nothing bullshit. You know?
No, and it's a shame. Yeah. I kind of like those. I'm a fan of the literary feuds. Whenever I read about some tiny, even the little ones, you know, on Twitter, like so-and-so. What? Someone like out somebody call her house or and gave a phone number of somebody she had a beef with.
Oh, that was Alice Hoffman. Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Yeah. Like
Alice Hoffman gave the reviewer's phone number away. That was really terrible.
But that's just is terrible.
That's what we're talking about. All or nothing. That's like really extreme.
That's really.
But I guess the extreme behavior is fascinating. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. There was no engagement. Where with Vidal and Mailer, there was an actual engagement. It wasn't just people spitting on each other and writing just ridiculously nasty reviews. Like the Giraldi, right now the big thing is
Alex Ollie and Giraldi. Yeah, I know.
I read a story of hers or two in the New Yorker a long time ago, but because of his horrible takedown and then his whole women want to be taken seriously, but then they write this
bullshit.
Drivel.
Yeah, yeah.
So now I have to go buy, I'm not going to read her novel. I have so much on my plate, but I'm going to go buy her story collection and read a few of them.
A number of people have said that. If anything, that review, I think it's the first bad review that has probably sold more books.
I bet it's not the first.
I mean, I have never seen a bad review get that level of basically, no, you've crossed the line. I've never, ever seen that. I mean, you know, normally when someone does a takedown, there's some sort of, you know, okay, it's a really mean hatchet job, but there's some purpose to it. But this, it's pretty much universally loathed, as far as I can see.
Yeah,
there are only a handful of defenders, and most of them work for the New York Times.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
But it made me curious about the book. It's interesting. So
I interviewed her too. Insight's really good. I like that. Let's move on to sex, which I feel is a very important component of this book. The sex with the Colin Farrell-like trucker, which we were talking about before. You know, it's described in this very direct and fierce language. The dick sex. There's this incident.
Her husband.
It's an aborted moment. Yeah, the dick sex. It's more about the smell. That whole section. And the trucker sex is more about describing, well, how huge the guy is and the cat's eye glow in the dark and so forth. Many literary writers end up writing really terrible descriptive scenes involving sex. every year you're guaranteed a very easy long list for the bad sex award in fiction.
Oh, isn't there? Yeah, there is an award. Yeah, I wonder if I'm going to get
there
one.
There is. I've actually, we'll like, I will sometimes, in fact, they've actually, like, when I read a book and I will tweet a particularly horrible, wonderfully horrible passage, and it ends up on the bad sex award list sometimes. I'm really funny. That's funny. But I wanted to actually ask you about this. What do you think creates a persuasive sex scene? Why do you think so many of these literary writers just cannot grasp such a fundamental aspect of life? And why do you feel that you have a better handle on this? Is it about is it about your tendency to stick with verbs? Is it about your tendency to stick with sensations? What do you think creates like a persuasive verisimilitude in a sex scene?
Wow. Well, I don't know if my sex scenes are better than other people's. I do know that they are very important to this book.
Yeah.
And they have a smaller or lesser place in certain stories that I've written as well. Philip Roth writes about sex in hilarious. And I'm not a huge fan of Portnoy's Complaint.
Yeah.
Sabbath Theater was hugely important to me. I thought it was hilarious and also visceral. And humor is, I think I use humor to a great extent. And sticking to the facts, you know, I don't try to make it pretty and there's not a lot of romance. I don't know, writing a romantic sex scene is probably something I'm never going to try to do. So watch me try to do it at some point. But so keeping the romance out, keeping humor in, and looking at the, you know, sex isn't really the most beautiful thing in the world, even though it also is.
Yeah.
But when writing about it, I wasn't writing about the beautiful aspects of it. I was writing about those are very satirical. There's three sex scenes, and they're all very, well, the one with her husband has been described as like also like incredibly graphic but touching or something.
Yes.
I think being incredibly graphic can be useful in that you take away kind of the sentiment, which can be, there's nothing worse than a cloying sex scene.
Yes.
I guess is what you're saying. I can't pick one out, you know, but I can't
The passage, The Kindly Ones, has this really hilariously awful attempt at the sex scene. And it's exactly what you say. When you're writing about something like the Holocaust, something that is so utterly serious and without any room for humor, you open yourself up to sheer ridicule or just badness, just awful prose. When you cannot take, that's my feeling anyway, and it's funny that most of the bad sex candidates, by and large, are either too serious or failed comedy, I would think.
Okay, or failed comedy. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I was trying to succeed. I mean, obviously, the masturbation scene in this book is supposed to be funny.
Yes.
You know, it's
I thought it was funny myself. So.
Those are my rules for it.
You were very good to at least give her the opportunity near the end. The timing of that was great, I thought.
I'm trying to think in some of the stories I write about it, and less graphically and more. Well, stories just have less room.
Yeah.
So you're not going to be writing about it as graphic is also perhaps lengthy, you know, description. Whereas occasionally in the stories, it's just a sentence or two. And that works out well because then you can't get yourself in too much trouble if you keep it to, you know, just not going too into it.
Yes. So I actually wanted to ask you as well about Sonia's favorite word, which is smug. She calls everybody smug this book. And
oh,
I wondered
boy,
if this
I
was
that. Yeah, you know, yeah. That's one of those things as a writer you just don't always see.
Oh, because I was reading this going, well, she's probably calling everybody smug because what Paula is trying to do here is sort of suggest that maybe there's something churlish beneath the resentment. There's something unthought out about her feelings. And I'm wondering, you know, clearly this was an accidental frequency, but I was wondering about why smug was such a go-to word here.
A few years ago, I read, it might even be, when I say a few years ago, I was like, oh, it might have been 10 years ago. Anyway, I read an interview with Mary Gateskill. Actually, I think it was about the time that Don't Cry came out, and she was being interviewed, and I forget the question.
Yeah.
But the answer was, basically, she was talking about morality, and what makes a person a good person, a bad person, and even sin might have been used. And she brought up smug, and smugness being something that is underrated as an incredibly destructive part of our society, that people who can't feel joy for others, that this is no little thing.
Yeah.
That she thinks it's a huge, like, worldwide problem. And I couldn't agree with her more. I wrote her a letter.
You've written many letters, I can see. Yeah.
You know what? I've written 3 fan letters in my life. Philip Roth, Mary Gateskill,
and
Jonathan Franzen.
Yeah.
Those are my 3.
Did Roth ever write you back?
He wrote me a little note back.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Little note, but still, you know, I'll take a sentence from Roth.
Yeah, I have info about Roth. I'll have to tell you off tape.
So that stuck with me because, again, I'm a lot like my father. And my father was raised in a Southern Christian home. And I'm sure they're not all the same. But it was one where people are, you know, polite to strangers, loving to their friends and family as much as they can be. And they try to do the good, right Christian thing. And I don't go to church. But my upbringing and the way I loved the way my father was in the world, and that's the way I like to be. You move to New York and you're just in a hole. You're in a whole cesspool of smugness, and so that I think that's where this comes from.
Yeah.
That's all I can say is that I do, but maybe, you know, maybe I didn't. I'm not saying I handle it correctly, but that's one of the things that I'm trying to criticize. In New York culture is schadenfreude, people's inability to be happy for each other, teaching, you know, the whole children as competition. You take something so precious and so important and you destroy it. It's when you turn it into what someone said, only in New York can children be both science experiment and work of art, you know, and there are little creations. And that's part of the smugness of, you know, not being generous as a community.
But see, Paula, the smug person would probably respond to your quibble and say, well, you know, I am joyful towards my friends, towards those who fall within my circle.
Right.
They've earned the right to my collective joy.
Oh, I see. Yeah,
the rest of these people, they're not, they don't rate in my book because they're more of a problem. And I choose, this is the New York way, Paula.
Yeah.
I don't understand why you have a problem with my smugness, especially since I've been so joyful to you.
That's a good point. But then they're wrong about themselves.
Yeah.
They're wrong about themselves. If it's just,
you're,
you know,
wrong about me.
Really?
How dare you? You're no longer my friend, Paula.
I could still. I still.
Sorry.
I mean,
don't know where this guy came from.
I still want to be able to believe. I still want to be able to be disappointed in people.
Yeah. You want that option always on the table.
I want to be able to be disappointed in people. I don't want to be so cynical that I expect someone's going to be a shithead to me, you know, just off the bat because they live on the Upper East Side and only hang out with people who live on Park Avenue, you know, or whatever. Yeah. Or even in Brooklyn, there's all these hierarchies. And I still want to be able to walk into a room and be like, hi, nice to meet you. And, and I'm not anybody that they really care to meet. And they don't have to immediately dismiss me or mock where my children go to school or, you know, look me up and down and see my shoes are not the greatest shoes or, you know, all of that. I want to be disappointed in those people. And that to me is the avoidance of being smug or the avoidance of, or still acknowledging that smug is this thing that I'm really, you know, I can see as a, something I don't want to do.
The people who stand in the way of egalitarianism and basic populist decency, I mean, it pisses me off too. But on the other hand, the fact is that all of us, without even knowing, occupy certain circles, certain areas that often surprise us of where we are or where we aren't. And, you know, it's almost an inevitable part of life. Is it fair to call someone else smug simply because they choose, unlike us, to abide by the bullshit coterie and clack code, as opposed to the sort of, hey, how's it going, which is more my style, too.
Well, I want to make excuses for certain people. For instance, all the people I wrote those letters to.
Yeah.
Probably you get to a certain point where everybody wants a piece of you.
Yeah.
And that's got to be a terrible place to be in. And then you're going to be protective, and maybe that looks like smug. But that, to me, is being protective, because you're at a position where everybody wants a piece of you. And I actually have some acquaintancy friends who are kind of on that edge.
Yeah.
And I feel for them. And that's different. That's just different to me. So I feel like you can differentiate. And you're right. And another thing is, as we get older, inevitably our world gets a little smaller, and inevitably we get more protective, even if we are not Philip Roth. You know, you're going to just, you're, when you're in your 20s, you know, I look back and I'm like, why did I let that woman stay with me for 4 weeks when her heroin boyfriend broke in and like took all, you know, her heroin addicted boyfriend broke in and like stole stuff and she was on my couch and never gave me a dime. Like, and that's something you do when you're 23. And now I'd be, you know, someone wants to come stay on my couch. No, you know,
yeah.
Just absolutely not. Like, I have two kids, two dogs, two cats, and I'm busy.
Did you see that New York Times Magazine article from a few weeks back? It was either written or edited by the, you know, Adam Sternberg, who I have mixed feelings about. And basically, it was sort of pointing to the epidemic of how difficult it is to maintain friends or have friends older in life.
How old is he?
Yeah, well, he's like, he's our age, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, so
in his 40s?
Yeah, he's probably like that.
Late 30s?
But yeah, late 30s or whatever.
That's a time of change. It's a big time of change.
It is, but at the same time, it again falls into this, you know, let's go ahead and grapple with the reality of growing older by drawing an all or nothing dichotomy that simply doesn't exist. Some people manage to retain vast reservoirs of friends as they get older.
Uh-huh.
Some people are lone wolves, and they're happy that way, by the way. You know,
well, this is what we were... I think there was another... Earlier on in our discussion, we were talking about the empty nest syndrome.
Yes, exactly.
Same thing. Some people are just like, okay, that was... It's time. Like, I kind of... On the one hand, I wonder how I'm going to adjust. One of my sons will be leaving the house in 2 years.
Yeah.
And part of me is ready for him. He's ready.
Yes.
And I can feel that. And so then if you feel he's ready, and so same thing with that, there is a transition. And you're right, I have a friend who's my age and he is so social, and every weekend he has people up and he has a guest house, and he's, you know, it's not just about the money, by the way, because a lot of people who don't have money. Oh, and my friends who live in this little apartment here, and he's a bartender and he's constantly throwing birthday parties for his wife. I haven't had a birthday party since I was six or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so everybody is different. And this idea, well, that's the problem with journalism, and that's why I have never heard of this writer, or in a way, I really don't read the Times very often, because journalism is so hyperbolic. And they have to have an angle. One time I wanted to write... See, I have this thing where when I go on airplane rides, and I do, I travel a lot, I buy all these men's magazines, because women's magazines just make me feel unattractive and angry.
Really?
Yeah. And it's been that way forever. And also really annoyed. So I buy Esquire, Maxim, Details.
And this is why you write Pregnancy Like a Man.
Well, you know, a lot of the stories in Baby are written from the male point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
And other people have said that I have a very masculine voice. I don't know what that means. You know, that's what people say about me. I'm just going to do what I do. And I can't really worry about that. So Maxim magazine is my personal favorite. I love reading about potato chips and beers and stuff like that. I just, when I'm on an airplane, that's all I can handle because I hate flying. But then I had an idea, and I do very little journalism. This was quite a while ago when I did a little bit. I wrote two articles for Time Out New York and, you know, did a little bit here and there. So I call them, I was upstate and I was at a demolition derby, and each car was like a piece of art that someone had spent an entire year on, and they were just beautiful, and they're all lined up, and they're all about to get destroyed. And that's so the art world, like, you know, art is a temporary thing, and, like, you know, installation art, or, you know, you can't go home and hang it on your wall, kind of, you know, this whole art theory.
Yeah.
And yet it's a demolition derby with these, like, greasers, you know, in upstate. So I call Maxim magazine and I pitch this, you know, I'd like to do a big photo essay and write about this demolition derby that's coming up at the, I forget, Wayne County Fair or one of those fairs. And he said, well, what's your angle? And then I immediately froze because I didn't have an angle.
Yeah.
I just said, they're really cool. And he was just like, that's not going to work. And I was like, oh. So a journalist, who you're, the man you're speaking about, he has to call his editor and say, here's my angle. It's really hard to keep friends when you turn this age.
Yes.
And they're like, oh, yeah, that's a great angle. And even though it's actually meaningless.
Yes.
But it's true. It's his truth. But he has to turn it into a universal truth.
Because you are being pressed to present an angle, journalism almost fills in all of the holes in the crossword, all the squares in the crossword.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas fiction does not.
No, and that's where I am happiest.
Yeah.
I like all the doubt. I like being able to, I like the messiness and the, you know, there's no, I'm not, even though there are a bunch of ideas that I'm discussing, I'm not giving you any answers, and I'm not making any grand statement, or I hope not. It doesn't come across that way.
Okay. Well, that seems a very good point to end this conversation. Paula, thanks so much. It was a pleasure yet again to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Ed.
We all come back sooner or later. As anything from a pussycat to a man-eating alligator. Well, you all may think my story is more fiction than it's fact. But believe it or not.